Good morning and welcome to the Public Safety Committee of the San Francisco Board of Supervisors. My name is Supervisor John Avalos, chair of the committee, joined to my right by Supervisor Christina Olague, who is the vice chair, and to my left by Supervisor Eric Marr. The clerk of the committee is Ms. Dang Braley. Also, Elisa Miller is here to help. We have two SFGTV folks who are helping as well, Jennifer Lowe and Nona Melkonian. Madam Clerk, could you share with us your announcements?
Yes. Please make sure to silence all cell phones and electronic devices. Completed speaker cards and copies of any documents to be included as part of the file should be submitted to the clerk. Items acted upon today will appear on the July 24th Board of Supervisors agenda unless otherwise stated.
Thank you. If you could please call item number one and two.
Item number one is a hearing regarding the impact of California's public safety realignment policy on the city and county of San Francisco. Item number two is a resolution approving the Public Safety Realignment and Post-Release Committee Community Supervision 2012 Implementation Plan.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. And I want to thank Supervisor Eric Marr for bringing these two items before us. Of course, the group doing realignment in San Francisco, the Community Corrections Partnership Executive Committee for their report as well. And since the sponsor of this hearing is Supervisor Marr, I will yield the microphone.
Thank you, Chair Avalos. I know how the issue of criminal justice and keeping our community safe with a humane approach has been a key goal for my colleagues Christina Olague and Supervisor Avalos as well. But I wanted to start with remarks by saying that a number of community-based criminal justice advocacy groups, from the ACLU to many others, have been working on this issue for decades. And I think seeing often issues of crisis kind of as an opportunity is a really important thing. But a recent study done by the ACLU released in March called Public Safety Realignment, California at a Crossroads, analyzed 53 different county or different programs within the state and gave really sound recommendations for policy changes. And I'd like to say that it's been a pleasure working with our law enforcement and criminal justice organizations in the city. It's made me understand what a great model San Francisco and other counties like Alameda are for other places in the state. It also raised questions of why Fresno County, for example, had been getting twice as much money when their programs are not geared towards really returning people back to their communities, keeping communities safe, but also reducing recidivism in our communities. But I think recently with changes at the California State Association of Counties and various criminal justice groups, we've been able to change the funding allocation so that it's a little bit more fair, but I think much more work needs to be done. I wanted to say to those that don't know about what's been happening, this hearing is about California's new public safety realignment policy and how it's impacted San Francisco's programs, again, as an opportunity to really improve them and show them as a model to the rest of the state. And as of October 1st, 2011, the Public Safety Realignment Act, or so-called AB 109, has required individuals in state prison for nonviolent, non-serious, non-sex offender felony offenses, so again, that's nonviolent and non-serious offenses, to be released to post-release community supervision, or PRCS, as we'll hear in the presentations, under the responsibility of our San Francisco Adult Probation Department and our Chief Wendy Still and her staff. This hearing allows us to better understand the impacts on the public in San Francisco and within our communities, and also the additional responsibilities that it's pushed onto counties and the local agencies of our various city departments and cities' ability to address the needs of the program, the issues. I did want to say that the ACLU report, besides saying that it's an opportunity, also talked about the challenges of funding in the state. And in some ways, the recommendations of increasing data gathering and really changing funding formulas to give incentives to good programs like San Francisco that reduce recidivism and incarceration and give great alternatives to incarceration, I think, are really key. I also think that the ACLU report and other criminal justice advocates kind of also point to the crisis of the criminal justice system in our state, and I'm looking forward to good comments from the public and our agencies about how we address San Francisco, but also California's terrible statistic that California is the highest state. Let's see, let me just read this. California's recidivism rate as a state, which is the rate at which people are released from prison and then returned back to prison. But California's percentage is among the highest in the nation at 67.5%. And how do we as San Francisco help to be a catalyst for other counties in the state as well? Also, there's the biggest financial crisis that we're seeing right now in our state. And how do we use the money that comes from the state wisely so that we're being a model, but also being fiscally responsible while also keeping our communities safe? With that, I wanted to say that we have great presentations, and then we're hoping to have good public comment as well. But I'd first like to introduce our representatives from the Community Corrections Partnership Executive Committee, and then they'll be giving presentations. And the first one is Chief Wendy Still of our Adult Probation Department, followed by Christine Soto DeBerry from the District Attorney's Office, Simon Shamji from the Public Defender's Office, Craig Murdoch from the Department of Public Health, Sheriff Vicki Hennessy, our sheriff, and Commander John Loftus from the San Francisco Police Department. But also joining us today as resources are Ms. Lonnie Kent from the Controller's Office, and they're supporting the CCPEC in tracking the data. And again, that was a key recommendation from the ACLU report, and also tracking the outcomes of the realignment implementation. And also the committee will provide a presentation on the impact of AB 109, or the Public Safety Realignment Act, in the city and county of San Francisco. And they'll also be presenting what our action item is, our city and county's public safety realignment and post-release community supervision 2012 action implementation plan. And on June 12th, I already introduced to the Board of Supervisors a resolution that to approve this plan, and hopefully we'll move that forward positively today. The committee of each county prepares this annual plan with recommended strategies in response to realignment. And last year, our 2011 plan was approved by the board on September 29th, right on time for the enactment of the realignment on October 1st. And in 2011, San Francisco was the first county in the state to approve our plan. And this year, we are again the first Board of Supervisors in the state seeing the plan for 2012. So I think we're ahead of the curve, and I know how great our programs are, and hopefully we'll highlight them today. So I'd like to invite Chief Wendy Still to begin the presentation. Thank you.
Thank you, Matt. Thank you very much, Supervisors. It's a pleasure to be here before you today and to talk about public safety realignment. First, I'll start out by saying that I'm really proud to be in San Francisco. I've only been here a little over 2 years, but there has the spirit of innovation and the collaboration amongst the criminal justice partners is what has made a very difficult, challenging situation such as realignment the most historic reform in California's history related to criminal justice be workable for us all. And I just would really like to recognize all the criminal justice partners for how hard they've worked together, collaborated, negotiated, and it's just been an absolute pleasure. With that, prior to public safety realignment, AB 109, there was another piece of legislation by our own Senator Leno, and that was called SB 678. And what that really did was started the whole evidence research-based criminal justice realignment process going. And in fact, what the legislation did is it created a community correctional partnership, and it's the criminal justice partners for each county. And the role of the partnership was to advise each county on implementing community corrections using evidence-based probation practices. And all that means, evidence-based, is looking at proven methods that have worked throughout the country, throughout the different counties, and taking those and implementing them within our probation system so that we can reduce the state's prison population. And that was really driven by the state's prison crisis They were facing a lawsuit, overcrowding lawsuit, and in fact, the Supreme Court did weigh in 2 years later and found the conditions of confinement to be unconstitutional. That's what really started this whole process rolling. And also, probation throughout the state was seen as an untapped resource, but that's really where the answer was, where if you could think of it as a hub to a wheel where all the partners could come together, because probation touches court, probation touches police, probation DA, public defender, and that, and basically community corrections, as the legislature saw it, was not being used as effectively as it could be. And so the incentive that they created, basically speaking also to Supervisor Marr's earlier point about creating funding formulas that reward behavior that works, SB 678 is a great example of that. What it did is for every probationer that was not failed on probation and was not sent to state prison below the average of what the counties had been sent in, there was a fiscal incentive. And I'm really proud to say that San Francisco, even though we have one of the lowest incarceration rates in the county in terms of sending, or in all of the counties, individuals to state prison, we were able to even successfully reduce that even more. And we were able to reduce that by a total of 48% since 2009. And what that did is that provided funding to be able to enhance the services. We made a decision within our county of how we were going to spend that money, and it was 100% on services. We have housing issues. We have substance abuse treatment capacity issues. We have education needs. We have employment needs. And where a lot of the counties took that money and spent it on additional staff or this or that, you know, we trained our staff how to use motivational interview techniques so staff could work better with the clients. We also spent a lot of money on training within the probation department so we could shift our culture, you know, because we had a culture within the probation department of really supervising from a law enforcement perspective, not rehabilitating. And so we were really having to teach many staff new skills and new concepts, because evidence-based probation, it is cutting edge. It's not like there's, you know, we've all been doing it for 20 years. And so there was cultural training and operational changes, many that had to be made. But I'm really proud to say that we went from sending an average of 256 2 years ago to an average 2 years later of 133. And I'm very proud to say, even in the first quarter of 2012, as compared to the first quarter when all of these efforts started, when we started the efforts, we were sending 62 on average to prison in that quarter. Quarter one of this year, we sent 14 probation failures. And it's not that we're just not sending them. Our successful probation termination rate is up. Our unsuccessful termination is down. And also, these efforts have resulted in contributing to dropping our probation population from 8,000 individuals down to the first time in history, well, for many, many years, to under 6,000. And so those are all statistics that move us in the right direction. But many counties were successful across the state. And in fact, 6,000 fewer probationers were sent to state prison. So the legislature thought, aha, you know, it is working. We were right. And so what they decided to do was to create this realignment, the governor and the legislature. And the key elements of realignment is that it established an executive community corrections partnership. So the CCP, as we call it, under the SB 678 that was created, basically it took a subset of those individuals, which is the sheriff, the chief adult probation, the public defender, the district attorney, the police department, and the board of supervisors locally within each county identified which type of social service agency, and ours was the director of public health department, and the courts, and this created the executive CCP committee. And each one of these committees throughout the state was, we were to prepare a public safety realignment and post-release community supervision annual plan. And was mentioned earlier, as we were the first county in the state to actually develop ours and have it approved. But being first isn't necessarily always the best, but in our case it was. And the reason that it was is because San Francisco took a balanced approach. We basically didn't take all of our money and say, we're just going to activate beds. Basically, we invested a significant amount of money and service dollars, and also such creative, progressive, and innovative things within the Public Defender's Office and the District Attorney, which they'll talk about a little bit later, alternative sentence planners. The sheriff looked internally, which she will talk about, at their operation, creating more programs. Probation opened a learning center in partnership with the Sheriff's Department in Five Keys Charter School. So basically, the investment in all of these services allowed us to start realignment out with a perspective of we need to build our plan to expand these services. We were really successful on SB 678, and basically we wanted to continue that success. And why it was not only a great thing for San Francisco to do, basically we created a plan that was a model. A lot of other counties didn't know where to start. And so basically it helped other counties throughout the state take a more balanced approach. Now, not every jurisdiction did decide to basically invest in as heavily in services as we did. But in fact, many did. And we received many notes of approval from jurisdictions in the other county. But what in fact the realignment did, also, in addition to creating the executive CCP, it redefined many felonies. So many felonies under now Penal Code 1170H that would have been punishable by sentences served in county or in state prison, now those services will be spent in county jail. And there's two ways that they can be served. They can be served either all jail sentences, or they can be split between jail and mandatory supervision. And we have, in fact, created a third way that they could be served, which is totally allowable under the law, but wasn't really thought about it in the first place. We're basically just using all aspects of the law, is 100% of it also could be spent on intensive community supervision. The other element of the law was it established a post-release community supervision and this population that was supervised by parole, in essence, non-serious, non-violent population, and that's only on their current offense. We'll talk a little bit later on in the presentation, but in fact, we have 67 of our current, roughly about 310, have 11 or more prior felony convictions. And so on average, our population that's coming from state prison has 8 prior felony convictions. And the majority of these have a serious or violent prior felony conviction. So the state was only looking at that just most recent incarceration. So in fact, what that means is we have a very high risk population. And San Francisco has a high-risk population, period, whether you talk about probation or PRCS or mandatory supervision, because we do so much to try and rehabilitate and change the behavior before we send individuals to prison. You know, we traditionally keep them on probation longer and make more attempts that you say would in a county like Fresno. And what that does is it increases the risk level. Those that basically are released from state prison, now that are the non-serious, non-violent, non-sex, are subject to supervision by adult probation. And also, the legislation encourages the use of evidence-based practices. One of the other really great aspects of the law is it finally began to give probation department tools to use in lieu of very lengthy, cumbersome, ineffective processes. One of those tools was flash incarceration. If an individual violates, has either an abscond or new arrest, it gives the local probation department the opportunity to take immediate, swift, and certain sanction. And that's what all the research out there tells us to do, is if somebody violates and the punishment isn't for 3 weeks, a month, 6 weeks down the road, and all that time that individual is sitting in a very expensive jail bed, then we've not really done anything to effectively change that behavior. And so the post-release, the flash incarceration is a wonderful tool. Also what it does is it sets that for those individuals that are successful, the post-released cases, for 6 months and not be arrested, if they've met all their terms and conditions of their supervision and also the goals that we've set for them in their individual treatment and rehabilitation plan, the chief of adult probation can terminate the supervision at 6 months if there's been no incarceration. And mandatorily, this population is terminated off of supervision at 12 months if there hasn't been any incarceration. And that's a significant change. And it also provides a significant incentive for a population. And that's what you want to do, is create a supervision model that has both rewards and it has sanctions. And what the evidence tells us is that you want to have a 4-to-1 ratio. And the evidence also tells us that you want to have 200 hours of a treatment modality, and past that you have diminishing returns. It also says supervision beyond 18 months of an individual has diminishing returns. And so we're taking all of that science, and we've incorporated that into our policies and our practices and our supervision models. And we are very pleased with the results. Other key elements of the public safety realignment is parole revocations. Parole revocations are now served in county jail rather than state prison for up to 6 months. And that's really significantly impacting the sheriff, which she will talk about in terms of the population, because parole has complete control on who they violate and who then begins to fill up the sheriff's jail. In July 2013, the parole revocations will stop being heard by parole, by what they call their Board of Prison Hearings, and they will become heard by the local courts. So that's another shift of workload and a shift of resources to the local level. Custody credits. Under the new law, those serving sentences in county jails, basically they're getting a day for day. They call it a 4 days to 2 days in terms of credits, but it's really what a day for day credit. So if they're sentenced for a 6 month for whatever reason in jail, in fact they will spend 50% of that time. They'll spend in fact 3 months. Alternative custody. It authorizes the use of home detention and electronic monitoring for county jail inmates in lieu of bail per the sheriff's discretion. And our sheriff department has very successfully been using electronic monitoring for a very long time. And in fact, that's why they've so successfully managed their jail population, that and many other innovative programs. But in fact, what it also does is it allows probation to utilize electronic monitoring and some other alternative sentences, so that we basically are not just incarcerating individuals, we are changing behavior.
So electronic monitoring is like an ankle kind of bracelet, or what is that? What's used these days?
That is correct. Okay. It is, as you would think of it, as an ankle bracelet, and basically there's a signal that ties back to sort of black box, as you think of it, or through the telephone lines, and then it notices if an individual goes out of range from where they're supposed to be at, that receiver range, then there's an automatic notification that happens, and then law enforcement is notified and then responds accordingly. In terms of the impact to adult probation specifically, our caseload are supervising the post-release community supervision cases, again, who would have been parolees under the old law. Our caseload is 110% of what CDCR projected. And in fact, so far to date, we've received approximately 306 clients. That was actually as the end of June. We're growing every day in terms of those reporting. We also anticipate that we'll be up to, within about a six-month period of time, about 456. And I think that that's where our range of these supervision cases are going to be, somewhere between 450 to 500. And that's just on the post-release cases. The other cases that we have are the 1170H sentencing. And that's another thing that San Francisco really has something to be proud about. There are a lot of jurisdictions that are just giving straight jail sentences. And what's unfortunate about that is that community supervision, if an individual is going to be successful, they need to transition out into the community, and that's where a lot of the tests are at. That's where a lot of the needs are at. So if they serve all their time in jail and they're released, they've completed it, and there's no what you would consider any type of supervision tail. And a supervision tail isn't important just to supervise, it's so they'll have access, these individuals, to services, to the programs that we're creating. And so our judges have taken a very balanced approach. And basically, we're seeing about a 50%, maybe a little bit under that when the report was made, 44%, but it continues to grow. And out of the 192 sentences, there have been 107 straight jail sentences, 56%. But what skews that number a little bit is when the law first went into effect in October, there were a lot of cases that were pending and weren't brought forward into court because they wanted the law to be passed and those individuals wanted to be sentenced under the new realignment law. So what that did was it built up a lot of sentence credits within the jail. So in fact, no matter what the sentence would be, because they had so many credits built up, they were released upon completing it. So, but the average length of time, the straight jail sentences is about 23 months. The jail time between the split sentences is approximately 14 months in jail, and then the mandatory supervision, 24 months. Now, this is the population that I'm very concerned about. The reason I am is that they're developing now these long supervision periods, and you can see the low sentence of split sentence or mandatory supervision is 1 month, and that's, again, because they had so many initially sentence credits. But really, the high sentence length, the split sentences were seen from 55 months and then mandatory supervision 78 months. This population will grow because if they're on supervision for 78 months, it will continue to grow and grow and grow. But we don't plan on just supervising. We're going to treat this population like we do our probation population, and also like realignment gave us the tools for the post-release supervision. We will develop an individual treatment and rehabilitation plan based upon a risk and needs assessment that we do for every single case. We are the only county that is going into the prisons and into the jails, and there are some counties that are going into the jails, but we're actually going into the prison, and we are doing the pre-release assessment, risk and needs assessment inside the prison. That allows us time to come back and to begin to connect up the service needs for that individual and make that reentry plan. And the other side benefit that we found from it is those that we've been able to go in and develop these plans for, they have 100% report rate, as compared to, say, if somebody was in a southernmost state where we couldn't get down there because of a short amount of time of notice, we have a higher abscond rate for those that we have not made that connection early on. Our current post-release community supervision client's prior criminal history, and this, in fact, is where we talk about this is not a non-serious, non-violent population. We basically have 28 of our cases that have 1 to 2 prior felonies, 3 to 5 prior felonies, 93, 6 to 10, 115, and 11 plus, 67 cases. 79% of our PRCSs and 85% of our 1170H clients are high-risk clients. That is really important. And I'm really proud that we can sit here and talk to you about what the risk levels are, how many prior serious and violent convictions. You know, this data is nicely presented. I really want to thank my great staff for doing that. But it took a lot of work on the front end, and it took all the criminal justice partners coming together and creating a cross-agency plan, how we would collect the data and what elements. And the controller's office is going to talk a little bit later on. But from day one, when we started talking about a realignment plan, knowing who that population was and what the demographic told us was just really critical so that we could effectively create plans and manage and also have this data so we can change. We think we know what we think we know, right? But in reality, until we get this population, we don't really know what their needs are. And so that's why it's really important for us to stay in tune with what, not only who is our population, where are they living, and what are their needs. Probation's response to realignment is we've done several things. We've created
Chief Still, can I just ask you to reemphasize how high risk the post-release community supervision clients are? It looks like 1 in 5 have 11 or more felony convictions, and the average is about 8 convictions of that total population of people?
That is correct.
So that's, yeah, I could see how extremely high risk the population is.
It is very high risk, and I really want to tell the board how much I appreciate your support during our last budget hearing. When we began to see the data in this high risk level, it was just immediately clear to me that I had to develop some lower caseloads, some 20-to-1 caseloads for those most highest risk cases. And you've supported us in that request, and so this is going to help us better manage, because this is really the population where we talk about public safety. Well, when you talk about 79% are high risk, it's a challenge in the first place. But those that have those kind of convictions, they need that intense supervision, not for supervision, but if we're obviously, there's been a lot of attempts. You know, they've been in and out of the system. You know, they've been convicted many times to get 11 prior felony convictions. So in order for us to develop really a successful plan, we're going to have to spend more time with them, more individualized time, and that's what that will allow us to do. In addition to the reentry division, and the reentry division includes our pre-release team and those individuals going into the jail and prison, but the reentry division has been so critical because part of that is the data. You know, we have a data element to this division. And then we also have those that are creating the plans, supporting the executive community correctional partnership, and key ones that are writing the contracts, the services, all the money that we've gotten from the state to put into service dollars. If we don't have anybody to write the contracts, then it doesn't do us any good. And so they've done a phenomenal job. They've staffed the committees, developed the plans, written and prepared, and really been a catalyst to continue the communication, the interdepartmental communication between, there's been so much work with public health to create the capacity that we needed. And the staff from both public health and my staff are so skilled, and I would just really like to recognize by name Jessica Flintock, who's the director of the realignment, the reentry division, and her staff, which Veronica Martinez, Leah Rothstein, and also Lauren Bell. They've done a phenomenal job. We also are in the process of hiring 20 new deputy probation officers, and 17 of them will be for these cases. We've shifted initially to cover because the population started coming in October. We've hired individuals that were our probation officers on our regular probation cases and shifted them over, which has created holes in my regular probation department, you know, and increase their caseload is really what it does. And so everybody within the department is really taking on a significant extra workload waiting for these new staff to come. We did not have an existing probation officer list, and in fact now we have done all the interviews. Another major thanks to the Sheriff's Department. They've done our backgrounds for us, and we anticipate these 20 will report the very first part of August.
Through the chair, Supervisor Olagi has a question.
Sorry.
I was wondering if you could give us some information on the demographic breakdown of this population.
I have a slide on that just a little bit later on.
Oh, okay, and then I'll have some questions related to, I guess I'm really excited to be working with you guys. I'm on the Reentry Council, as you know, and it's really, I think, incredible work that the focus is really truly on rehabilitation of the individual. And I think everyone, or the majority of people, want to be able to improve themselves, improve their lives. And without the resources and the right type of counseling, whether or substance abuse, the ability to heal, then obviously, probably the incidence of recidivism increases. I mean, I think logic would tell anybody that. I don't think it takes a lot to figure that out. So I noticed that there is that strong emphasis on motivational interviewing and this sort of thing. So at some point I wanted to have a better understanding of the cultural competency. Sure. And the training that staff is required to do, and what is the demographic makeup of the staff, just, you know, people that are dealing directly with this population. I just want to make sure that that's something that's being strongly considered when...
That's a really good point, and I won't wait till we get to later on in the slide. What I can tell you is roughly about 60% of our population is African-American, very disparate, you know, and so we're really focused on creating services and partnerships with agencies. We went out to bid RFP for the probation dollars as well as the AB 109 dollars, And we really had a focus in how we wrote that RFP to have cultural competency be part of the proposals that were sent back to us in terms of how are they going to achieve it, as well as we went out into the communities and the communities of where the population we know are at and need to be served. And we actually had two of our community correctional partnership meetings out in the communities, again, trying to do outreach. In addition to that, we also say, for example, out of the new officers that we're hiring, we know also we have a need for bilingual Spanish speaking, additional officers for that. So five of the officers that we're hiring have special conditions on the actual requisition that we will be hiring five individuals that have those bilingual Spanish speaking skills. In addition to that, we have one that we have a special condition for Cantonese. And so we really are paying attention to that. And I didn't bring the demographic makeup of our staff, but it very closely mirrors the population that we're serving, very closely mirrors. And so I'm very excited for when we open our Community Assessment and Service Center. Leaders in Community Alternatives will be the contractor that is providing the services there. But again, when we wrote that contract, we wrote it specifically in, so that would be not only cultural competency also, but gender responsiveness,
right.
You know, not
That's
taking
right.
a one-size-fits-all
right.
approach.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Absolutely. In terms of their needs, I can tell you without even looking at a slide, our populations need substance abuse services, they need housing, they need education, they need jobs. But the type of things that we don't really talk about in terms of needs or haven't historically is if an individual has an antisocial criminal attitude, right? They also need to go through a cognitive behavioral therapy class, such as Thinking for a Change. So we reached out to the National Institute of Corrections, and they are coming in August, and they will be training 30 of our staff. And it will be probation staff, we've invited the Sheriff's Department, and also the Leaders in Community Alternatives, so that we can also begin to provide these type of services. Because we don't want to just contract out for everything. We want our staff also actively engaged. And the sheriff will probably talk about a reentry pod that we've been working on together and wanting to bring inmates back from state prison even earlier than they're supposed to, so that we have an opportunity to do that pre-release work inside the jail prior to release, and then having my officers go inside to do those individual treatment and rehab plan and put on those type of classes.
Supervisor Ologi.
When you mentioned, of course, you know, the ideally, you know, the contracting out would be limited, obviously, but in the Bay Area, you know, I know that a lot of this, the emphasis is on, you know, rehabilitation and, you know, counseling and this sort of thing. And there's no lack of schools that focus on psychology in the Bay Area, right? So I'm wondering, what are the internships? I mean, are there partnerships that occur? I know City College, for instance, has a community mental health certificate. So California Institute of Integral Studies has a community mental health program. So just wondering if that's something that, you know, I know that these are people that are still working towards their licensure, and so it's not that, you know.
That's a wonderful question.
I'm just curious, yeah.
Yes, we do. We have partnerships.
Okay.
We have partnerships with a variety of schools, and it's basically the students that come to us, but we have I think we've had students from UCSF, we've had students from the local community college, Sonoma State, who has a major criminal justice program, also has students come. And part of a succession planning, a plan that I developed 2 years ago, was to bring interns in and to allow the interns to get school credits and work credits. And that also helps us change the culture
right.
of the organization moving towards a treatment model. But then in addition to that, we created the use of probation service aides, which is a temporary class. So the interns that are successful and do a good job can transition into probation service aides, get some real experience, and then when we give the test, like which we just gave, we had a number of our interns and probation service aides actually take the test. And that's part of a long-term succession plan, so we continue to build that. The other thing that we're working on a very strong partnership with is we've just had one of my officers, deputy probation officers, was just hired by the community college to be the director of criminal justice program for the Southeast campus. And so we're working closely together and, in fact, designing a model to where we're opening a Bayview office, and we'll have that open probably within this month. But in addition to that, have our officers go on campus to try and make it easier for those students that are complying and they're going to school and they're complying with their plan. We want to make it easier for them to report rather than to have them have to come all the way down to the Hall of Justice. And so in addition to that, we've got an agreement from Community College to also allow us to have priority registration for our probationers, because they, and for our PRCS and AB 109, the 1170s, because a lot of our population's challenges are, people talk about rehabilitating, but in fact, they've never been habilitated. You know, there's a lot of life experiences that they've just not had, so they need individuals to help them through the process. And so that's what we're spending a lot of time doing, is trying to develop that capacity and the relationships, like with Department of Public Health. You know, sometimes we'll walk our clients over to, or drive them over to Public Health to make sure they get there and that they get engaged with the service referrals that we've done.
Okay, thank you.
Supervisor Marr?
Yeah, since you were talking a little bit about the demographics, I know that your leadership at the state level has been around women in prisons and reforms. So it looks like women are about 7% or a much smaller percentage than men. So how do we address kind of issues of women that are within this population? And then the second question that's related to Supervisor Olagi's, it looks like 60% or so is African American, and then about maybe 12 to 15% are Latino. So my guess is that there's a significant English learner or people whose language, first language is in English, and I'm wondering how we deal with an immigrant or a language minority population of these populations.
Okay, thank you. Well, a couple of things. Well, yes, I spent one of the roles that I had previously in the prison system was to reform all the state prisons' female offender programs and services in prisons for the governor at that time. And basically, I developed the blueprint, the plan to the legislature that was required by penal code. I had brought experts in to help us develop that plan. And so what we've done in San Francisco is I reached out to those same experts and asked them to come to San Francisco to help us, partnering with the Sheriff's Department, to develop a gender-responsive plan for our criminal justice system to make sure that we were basically had the right services. One, we knew the population, what the needs were of women, because a lot of times, if we just take a look at the overall population needs, they're very skewed, because women being 7% as compared to men being 93%, when you actually disaggregate the numbers and you take a look at it, the needs are very different. And so happy to report that they anticipate that that plan will be done. We've had a series of workshops, meetings involving both sheriff staff, my staff, community staff. And I'm also happy to report that that work, I went to Zellerbach Foundation and I asked them for a grant. And so an outside foundation thought that this was so important that they funded this grant. And Zellerbach has been a real friend to the city and to a real friend of specifically probation. I think we're on our third grant now. And the grants have been focused at women and children. And so after we have the blueprint, then we will be making some adjustments. We've already got some strategies that we're working on. I have a dedicated caseload in my 18 to 25-year-old, you know, basically for young female probationers. We will create that same type of caseload for our 1170H also, and our AB 109 as soon as we have some of the new staff report. But in addition to that, when I talked about, you know, RFPing out the money for services, we also put in there gender responsive requirements as well as, again, cultural competency. So the type of services that we bring up, we'll consider, and how we also distribute the money will be ensuring that we have an adequate number of services for the type of women that we're supervising. In terms of the language and access to, certainly we, you know, we use throughout the department the language line, but in addition to that, again, we have positions that we have special conditions that we've put on, you know, whether it be Spanish speaking, Cantonese, or other languages to help us with that communication. But also the type of agencies that we're developing partnerships with, we're also taking that into consideration so that we can refer a client to the right type of a service program that that individual will be, will feel comfortable and will basically have a meaningful experience. So that's a three-pronged strategy. Partnerships so far with the service providers include just a few examples, the Asian Neighborhood Design, job training through SFDPH Emergency Stabilization Housing Units, through behavioral health, mental health, substance abuse, and case management, through the Human Service Agency, Housing, Hamilton, Rental Subsidy, Reentry San Francisco Partnership, Comprehensive Services, Job Readiness Placement, Five Keys Learning Center. The other thing that I've really went after a lot of is grant dollars, and we've been very successful. We've received over $1 million grant for substance abuse and job training, one of the second chance grants. I created a probation alternatives court, and that's why when we were able to drop our population of who we were sending to prison, we just didn't not send them. We have this very intensive court that focuses on wraparound services and a treatment team that involves the district attorney, the probation department, the public defender, and a specialized courtroom, and we have the services wrapped around them. And again, it's not a one-size-fits-all. It's where will this individual be successful in what type of a program?
I actually have another meeting,
sure.
Budget and Finance.
Okay.
That's at the same time. It's going to be probably about 50 minutes long, so I'm going to step out, but I'll come back because I am very interested in your presentation, and Vice Chair Christine Olage will take over the chair while I'm out.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Supervisor. Okay. The Five Keys Learning Center, again, I just want to mention that for a minute. 2 years ago when we started this reform, probation had no services. And so we reached out to the Sheriff's Department and the Five Keys Charter School, and they created, we had an empty room filled with broken desk and chair, cleared that out, and now it is a live learning center where we've graduated individuals for their GEDs, their high school diplomas. We will also be creating this same type of a learning center within our new community assessment and service center. We actually had a graduate that was part of the graduation ceremony during this last graduation that was 61 years old. And he's been in and out of the criminal justice system his entire life. And when he got up to give his speech, he thanked certainly the teacher from Five Keys and his probation officer, because if it wouldn't have been for her, that he felt confident that he would have never finished. It was her encouragement. Again, sometimes it's a reward, encouragement, a sanction, but he did. And I'm happy also to report, 3 months later, I was in the learning center, and the same individual who was no longer on probation was in that learning center, still continuing to move his education forward. He had signed up for another class, and he was going to community college, but it's just the type of environment that we want to create. We want probation to be a place where people want to come and can get help to change their lives. So
I just wanted to comment briefly that in my observation, if the wraparound services aren't in place, then frequently we're just setting people up for failure. You know, you throw them into jobs, you throw them into housing with no support whatsoever. How are they supposed to be able to readapt to this change in their life? So I'm happy to hear that there's such an emphasis on wraparound services.
That is just so true. These individuals, and that's why we were talking about the time that on community supervision is so important, because more so than being necessarily incapacitated, because so much of the population, probably about 85%, has a substance abuse related type of issue. And so, but they also need to have a place stabilized that's safe so we can send them to services and have them deal with that need and then step them into the next part of their program, which could be not even going to get a job, just job readiness kind of training. And that was that one grant that I was talking about, has substance abuse services as well as job readiness. And then you go to the next level, which would be employment. And the other part of the specialized caseload I was talking about in our youth, our transitional age youth, the gender responsive caseload, we have just some wonderful staff in there. And she develops a plan, and it's called a success plan. So most of our probationers have about a 3-year probation sentence. And what she does is she puts them on an 18-month success track. Her goal is for them to be able to achieve all of the goals within the plan. And if they do, then she will take them back to court and basically ask the court for reconsideration. And again, it's about giving them the lifeline a lot, and that's where the motivational interviewing really comes into how important it is with the officers, so they're engaging the population, but also if the individual ends up in difficulty so that they can call, and they know that they can call their probation officer and they'll get some help, not just get, you know, a sanction.
Chief Still, can I just say that at 1 p.m. there's a scheduled Government Audits and Oversight Committee meeting. We're going to have to keep moving this along, and I apologize for asking so many questions, and I know we have other presentations coming up as well, but thank you so much for the great presentation.
Absolutely, and I'm almost done with my part. But in addition to that, we have basically been picked as one of 4 jurisdictions in the United States to do this Soaring 2 project, and it's a computer-based training for evidence-based practices. All of our staff will be going through that. Again, we keep reaching out for what's innovative and progressive out there that we don't necessarily even have to pay for. But in terms of the demographic information, this is where we begin to look at it. In terms of so far the PRCS clients by zip code, what I can tell you is the areas where the population, it's of course the Soma, the Tenderloin, and the Bayview. That's where the population, the greater needs are. The mandatory supervision by resident zip code, it's the same thing. That's where the concentration. There are certainly others within other zip codes, but that's where we know that we have to establish the services for. Now I would like to turn it over to the district attorney's office. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, supervisors. Thank you for having us. I just want to thank Chief Still for the great work she's doing and the work we've all been working on here jointly. I'll be very brief unless you have questions. As it relates to the district attorney's office, we have a very small portion of the budget, most of it's going obviously to probation and to the sheriff's department, but the funding that we did receive last year and we'll receive again this year, we have put entirely towards hiring an alternative sentencing planner. This is a position we created in our own office. We believe, I'm certain we're the only people doing it in the country, at least under this rubric. And what we felt we needed to do was really bring in some expertise besides legal expertise into our office to help the lawyers navigate the different sentencing options. So we've hired somebody with more of a case manager background that's from the community, has extensive experience and knowledge of the different community organizations and programs that exist, and on request helps the attorneys explore alternatives to an incarceration-based sentence. We do this in the realignment cases, so he reviews all of those files to see which ones may need some additional attention. Thus far, that's been over 500 cases. And then digs in on those where there are particularly challenges, either with the client or the charges or some public safety issues. And in those, really works with the attorney to try and structure a sentence that will minimize or eliminate incarceration as the sentence and create more of a community-based solution. We are finding great success in this program and, in fact, are hopeful to find ways to expand it. We have really found that with our transitional age youth, our 18 to 25-year-olds, a lot of our attorneys are seeking out guidance with these cases because they're young people and serious cases, but somewhere we're trying to find an alternative besides state prison. And so we're seeing growing need for this type of service. But we're very proud of it. We talk about it everywhere we go. I just went to represent the district attorney at the District Attorneys Association meeting for California, and I got a lot of questions afterwards about the work because it's something that nobody thought about doing with their realignment dollars. They use them all to hire new line staff and are now having difficulty justifying those new hires. And so I think are interested in trying to understand what it is that we're working on. The other area that we have made some minor adjustments in our work is around our early resolution program. This is the courtroom where we send cases very early in the process to try and reach a settlement. There's certain types of cases that go there. We're trying to funnel most of the realignment cases there so that we can get them resolved quickly and not clog up courtrooms and that we can get the person onto a treatment and out of the courthouse. And then the Sentencing Commission was legislation that District Attorney proposed and was sponsored by Supervisors Wiener and Cohen. That is the first of its kind at the county level. The state, through Senator Leno, has tried several times to create a sentencing commission unsuccessfully. So we thought perhaps we could start our own and that that might encourage the state that they may too want to look at their sentencing practices. That will be convening in August for the first time. It involves all of our criminal justice agencies as well as appointees from the Family Violence Council and the Reentry Council and a few other agencies. And we expect to tackle some very interesting work in that. It'll sort of be an opportunity for us to all open our books and say, what have we been doing? Is it working? What could we be doing better? What changes we'd like to see at the state level that may propel better criminal justice outcomes and reforms? We look forward to being able to report back on that work as it gets underway. We've also spent an extensive amount of time training our staff. First, initially helping them understand the law, what it meant for sentencing, what types of sentences they could or could not legally request in a courtroom, and then more nuanced training. We've brought in the Department of Public Health to do training on addiction and addictionology. We've brought in mental health advocates. We've brought in our alternative sentencing planner has done several trainings for our staff on different housing options, really trying to educate them on the breadth of services that are available and which ones may be appropriate in particular scenarios. And we continue to do that and engage in that ongoing training. And then lastly, I would say that we have very excited. We just, through a grant, were able to partner with Delancey Street and we have opened our own housing, 15 beds. And we have Delancey Street going into, they just went into San Bruno Jail, thanks to the sheriff, and are discussing the program, a very Delancey-based model, but separate from their larger structure. And we have a lot of interest and uptake in that. And so we are now also able to offer some housing to people as they're exiting the county jail and looking to make that transition. Those are sort of the big highlights. Happy to answer any questions.
Good. No, any questions? No? Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much.
And I think the next speaker is from the Public Defender's Office, Simon Shamji. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. Good morning, supervisors, and thank you for allowing me this opportunity to address you. So the Public Defender's Office provides high-quality representation and due process protections for the individuals that are on PRCS and on mandatory supervision. And what the public defender has done is created a realignment team that consists of an experienced attorney who has worked in the collaborative courts and has a lot of experience working with the population in improving legal outcomes, and additionally, a clinical social worker. And together, they work with the individuals that are currently on PRCS, currently on mandatory supervision. And what the team has done and will continue to do is to design and advocate for alternative sentencing strategies. And we've heard that over and over again. And really, what we will be doing is making sure and advocating for individuals to not be incarcerated, for individuals to be released from custody and engage in either collaborative courts, community courts, or other alternatives so that we are not simply changing the address from state prison to the San Francisco County Jail. And the team together will provide the courts with information that they need to make better decisions about the outcomes. Additionally, the realignment team will be advocating for expansion of the eligibility criteria and capacity for the collaborative courts. Now, we've heard that we have effective collaborative courts in San Francisco. It's the behavioral health court, or whether it's the community justice center or drug court. And at this point, there, this is a great opportunity to expand on the capacity there so that individuals can avail themselves to these services, which have proven to be effective and have completely different recidivism rates, especially the drug court, where the recidivism rate is less than 20%. And so the way that we have the way that the eligibility criteria is now is that we can really expand the criteria so that it can include some of these individuals who have these prior convictions who may not be eligible for drug court or for behavioral health court, and yet we know that these end up being more effective in many cases than incarceration. And again, you've heard of the coordination and the collaboration that is taking place between all of the agencies. I've been with the Public Defender's Office for 17 years, and this is the first time that there is this incredible collaboration between district attorney, between probation, public defender, Department of Public Health, and it's all of us coming together that is improving the outcomes. We're working together to identify resources, strategies. There is transparency, and without any of the departments really compromising on their traditional roles, this coordination and collaboration is really important, and so our realignment team will continue to maintain those relationships with the Reentry Council, be a part of the Sentencing Commission, work with the Sheriff's Community Programs, and work with the District Attorney's Alternative Sentencing Planner, et cetera. Additionally, the Public Defender's Office has a reentry unit where we have six social workers, we have the Clean Slate Program, and the realignment team will continue to coordinate so that we can work closely, work together to lift those barriers that exist for individuals, provide the information that the courts, that the district attorney, that the probation officer might need about the individual client, and work in that area. Again, there's lots and lots of training that's required. The law is changing in this area. Clients need to be advised of their rights to understand. Lots of clients think that they're still on parole, and just explaining to them not only what their rights are under PRCS, what their rights are as it relates to flash incarcerations, because ultimately the due process protections are critical in this process. And if it's appropriate to file a motion to terminate mandatory supervision, to make sure that individuals that are entitled to be terminated from post-community release supervision or on mandatory supervision, that that actually happens and that there's legal representation for them if it doesn't happen automatically, as the probation department might be able to do. And then ultimately, if we are not able to resolve a case and we find ourselves in the court system, then the attorney working with the social worker will investigate the case, will prepare and conduct any revocation hearings that are necessary. So, thank you.
Thank you so much.
And thank you for providing us with some perspective, you know, knowing that you've been here 17 years, because it seemed really exciting and sort of unique what's happening right now.
It is.
And I was wondering if that was the case. And it seems that there's one mind now operating, trying to figure out ways to really help people, you know, integrate back into society in a real way.
Yes, absolutely. There's a sea of change happening now.
Great. Thank you for providing that.
Thank you. The next speaker is Craig Murdoch from Department of Public Health.
Good morning, supervisors. My name is Craig Murdoch with the Community Behavioral Health Services of the Department of Public Health here in San Francisco. And I just want to reiterate some of the comments that were said earlier with regards to the collaborative relationship that we've had with the probation department and with our other criminal justice partners in the city. It has been a truly impressive and amazing process, a refreshing process for us. The amount of collaboration, the amount of interface, and the amount of sharing of information that has occurred. in implementing this effort. So within the Department of Public Health, we consider the offender and ex-offender population a vulnerable population. It's a population that we know is of high need, that presents with levels of acuity that are often outside the norm and require very, very specific interventions to assist individuals in transitioning back into the community. We also know that it's generally speaking, individuals who are recidivating throughout the criminal justice system are also recidivists through our public health system, that the individuals that are returning to jail, that are being rearrested, are also the individuals that are cycling through, say, our emergency department at San Francisco General or at any one of our primary care clinics that we operate throughout the city. So we have a very, very vested interest in seeing that this population, that this cohort of individuals are reentering the community and are receiving the services it is that they need. So over the course of the last fiscal year, the probation department referred to DPH 293 individuals. 293 individuals that for based on the risk assessment and on the COMPASS tool may have needed some sort of level of care, be it substance abuse, mental health, primary care services. And what I've included in the slide here is just some basic information with regards to the numbers on the more high-profile and premium services it is that we offer. 17 individuals were presented with serious mental illness, and we're talking serious mental illness. These were very high levels of acuity, individuals that were on multiple medications, had multiple episodes of involuntary 5150 suicide attempts. We had 36 individuals that were placed in long-term residential treatment services, 44 that went into outpatient services, and 16 that were transitioned into some of our stabilization and transitional housing. We did receive some resources this past year for this population, and we were able to piece together a sort of small spectrum of services, but 72% of all the services that were, 73% I should say, of all the services that were provided were through the larger system of care. And that involves a range of services, everything from bed bug abatement to TB testing to medication management to 5150s, the few 5150s that have occurred over the course of the year. So it's a very broad range of services it is that we've had to provide to this population. And just as far as primary care health issues, I've just highlighted some of the things it is that we see in high prevalence. Obviously, high blood pressure, coronary conditions, diabetes, and this population is very much susceptible and exposed to hepatitis C. And a very interesting fact it is that we actually came upon a couple of weeks ago is that 21 individuals that were providing services were affected by HIV or had an HIV diagnosis. All of those individuals lived in the 92124 zip code, which is the Bayview, and all of those individuals were previously known to the Department of Public Health. So they were affected by their disease prior to being sent to state prison. And upon their return to custody, we were able to connect them to services relatively quickly because we knew who they were. And we already had a clinical workup to some extent that we could use to continue their care. So in that instance, we're looking at some very, very seamless care that is greatly that is really supporting this population in many different ways.
Mr. Murdoch, can I ask a budget question?
Yes, sir.
You mentioned that 73% of the individuals that you served were outside of realignment funded capacity, and I realize that with the new formula that there's a little bit more money that goes into public health, maybe about $250,000 more per year?
Correct.
Is that going to help?
It is. It's going. We did an analysis of what we thought that our needs would be for this year. For the first year of operation, there was a lot of crystal balling that had to occur. We did not know to what extent this population was going to be affected by public health concerns or needs. So it was very, very difficult. It was a very, very challenging process trying to ascertain the true level of resources that would be required during the first year. Subsequent to that, we've had an opportunity to take a step back, look at our budget, look where the services need to be, look where we can optimally expense them. And we think that we have a budget going forward into the new year that will cover the cost, the true cost as experienced in this fiscal year, or the fiscal year that was just ended. And then I mentioned a little earlier the small system of care areas that we created within the Department of Public Health, and there's the modalities that were funded to some extent, residential treatment, outpatient services, primary care, as well as the stabilization housing. I should also mention that San Francisco and our Department of Public Health is the only public health authority in the state that operates a primary care clinic exclusively for this population. Individuals that were entering the community from state prisons are eligible to receive primary care services at what we call our transitions clinic. This is a clinic that is operated by an MD, a doc within the department. It's located within Southeast Health Center, and any of the individuals that are AB 109 suitable, eligible, that come our way and need or have primary health care issues can be referred to the Transitions Clinic for a relatively immediate connection to primary care services in the city. One thing it is that we did create with the resources that we were provided with this last year is what we're calling the Realignment Case Management Unit within the Department of Public Health. This is a constituent program of the Behavioral Health Access Center, which is located at 10th and Howard Street. And this is I don't like to use the term one-stop shop, but it is. It's a one-stop shop. It's a place where individuals can come, where they can see a clinician, where they can be provided with a range of care and a range of services that will support them in their reentry back to the community. So it provides care coordination and case management to this population up to assessment, referral, and authorization for placement into various levels of care within the Department of Public Health. It's a high-profile program. We work very closely with the Adult Probation Department, the DPOs at the Probation Department. Oftentimes will escort or bring the probationers to the Realignment Case Management Unit for services. It's at this venue that we can also enroll participants in Healthy San Francisco and SF-PATH if they're not eligible for Medi-Cal or any other entitlements. We also provide on-site toxicology screening, and as I mentioned before, we do work very, very closely through coordinated case conferencing and case management with the individual DPOs so that we can ensure that the probationers are meeting minimum treatment expectations and are transitioning, you know, into the community. So the year that started just now going forward, we're very, very excited because there's some really truly innovative and interesting initiatives it is that we're going to be embarking on. We are going to incorporate additional treatment capacity with the additional resources that we will receive this year. We will be expanding the provision of residential treatment, dual diagnosis treatment, and we'll be substantially expanding the amount of transitional housing that we provide to this population. We'll also be hiring 3 FTE clinicians to work with this population. 2 of these individuals will actually be working at ADP's Community Assessment and Resource Center. So they'll be outstationed, co-located with the probation department to better coordinate care and to improve the communication between the Department of Public Health and ADP. And as just with regards to the cultural competency and with regards to the connection to institutes of higher learning, all of the staff it is that we hire for the Realignment Case Management Unit have to be certified by one of the 3 certification entities at City College of San Francisco. So they either have to have received or are in the process of receiving either their community health worker certificate, their community mental health certificate, or the CADAC, the Drug and Alcohol Substance Abuse Services Certificate. Okay. And that's uniform across all the staff that we hire. And we also have 2 CIIS interns that work with this population, which has proven highly effective. And then within the Realignment Case Management Unit and within the Behavioral Health Access Center, we have the capability on-site live people. We have a spread of 7 languages, all of the threshold languages. For San Francisco County. So we're very proud of the fact that we're able to communicate with such a broad range of individuals on a face-to-face basis without having to use the language line. And we're also, the Realignment Case Management Unit is a pilot process for teleinterpretation. So we now have a system in place where if we do have a language that's outside of the threshold, we can contact a vendor and actually do translation by TV.
I guess in I have to ask this question.
Yes,
sir. I'm trying to like limit it, so because I know we have to race through this agenda. But I just requested an informational session on housing and for this population, and hopefully, I guess it'll come up in August or I don't know when, September maybe. Mm-hmm. But I know that you mentioned that you're focusing a lot more resources into the transitional housing.
Yes.
Piece. And I think it might be, hopefully you'll be participating in this discussion when we have this hearing at the Reentry Council. But I guess one of the issues that I hope that you're able to address, and if not you, maybe then we need to invite the planning department or something even outside of the bodies that are here currently, is in my past experience or observation, there's been a lot of resistance in neighborhoods to reintegrating these populations into their, you know, blocks, their areas,
yeah,
their homes, and near their homes. So I think that we need to also address that issue at some point of, you know, how do we, the stigma of integration or reintegration.
There is that stigma and there is that NIMBYism, but another big challenge and a big barrier is just the cost.
Yeah,
is just trying to find some affordable housing for these individuals who are on extremely limited income is very, very challenging, especially if you're trying to get them out of the mix, so to speak. If you want to get them out of the central city, the Tenderloin, areas that they already know, areas that they have previous.
Yeah.
You know, it's challenging, and that's been one of the biggest challenges that we have. And I think that the department, DPH, has had a concerted effort over the last couple of years to try to source housing, you know,
right,
that is outside those traditional areas of, you know, SROs
exactly,
and single-room occupancy establishments. And
right,
so I think that it's a big issue, it's a broader issue, and I think that it does warrant a considerable amount of discussion, and I would be happy to participate in any discussion pursuant to that.
That would be good, and then I think to emphasize, too, some of these other related issues,
mm-hmm,
like the one you just mentioned, which is, you know, for the individual to bring them back in to areas where they were previously, mm-hmm, and engage in, you know. So how does where we place certain folks impact their ability to recover and
right,
rehabilitate themselves? And it would be interesting to get it from that person's perspective.
Correct.
To ask them, you know, like, okay, if you were placed here, how would that impact your ability to recover, you know, to move on in your life?
Sure.
Versus,
I mean,
if you were placed in an area that, you know,
right,
where you don't have that same kind of history.
You're always hoping for a positive trajectory. You're always hoping
right,
that the individual is going to be able to meet certain milestones and expectations
yeah,
in improving their life and reintegrating back into the community, and to what extent does their living situation prevent them or just make that all the more difficult and
right,
all the more challenging? So, yeah, I do agree, Supervisor, that it is a large issue that does warrant a much broader and more in-depth discussion.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, Supervisor.
Thank you, Mr. Murdoch. The next speaker is Sheriff Vicki Hennessy. Thank you for being here, Ms. Hennessy.
Oh,
Sheriff Hennessy.
Thank you for inviting me. I appreciate it. Good morning, Supervisors. It's very exciting to be here. I was just reflecting, in 1977, I was a deputy assigned to the first Women's Work Furlough Program, which was inside city prison, the old city prison on the sixth floor of the Hall of Justice. So we've come a great distance over the years, and I have to commend, of course, former Sheriff Michael Hennessy for all the work that he did. And I also want to echo that the collaboration in this effort and currently since I've been in this position, in this recent position, has been great. And once again, I also want to acknowledge the leadership of Chief Still and all the work that's been done. We're talking about impacts to the Sheriff's Department for AB 109. And we're very fortunate because the Sheriff's population has seen a steady decline in inmate population, and it's been hovering around 1,500 to 1,550 for the last 2 to 3, 4 months. And prior to that, it was about 1,700 last year and 1,900 the year before. So it's been going down. And what that has allowed us to do is just use the resources we've always been using for in-custody programs and for community programs, and to use them now for this population that's coming out of state prison or coming directly to us instead of to state prison. So I have a slide here. It talks about the parole violations we've seen. Those have really jumped, and I think Chief Still mentioned that I was going to mention that. Yes, they have jumped quite a bit, and the total that we've had is about 1,439 parole violations in the last 10 months, which is a dramatic increase. We used to have maybe 20, 24 a month at the most. That's, you know. So this is kind of unheard of. However, and if you look at that, some of them are sentenced to county jail time for parole violations, and some are released without any further efforts on our part. We have a number of violations versus the parolees, and some parolees, once again, we're talking about violations, not people. So some of these people have violated more than once, sometimes more than twice. Okay.
Sheriff Hennessy, what are the reasons for that huge increase in parole violations?
I wish I knew the answer to that. I would expect that what's happening is that the state prisons have paroled more people in recognition of realignment, and so now it's coming to the local level. I do agree, though, that handling this at the local level makes some sense in terms of reentry.
Okay.
So, and then on 1170 cases, you can see here we've had 125 people who have straight sentences and 58 with split sentences. And I think Chief Still kind of went over all those definitions for you, and I didn't want to go through that again in the interest of time. As we go through our plans for the AB 109 population, one of our biggest plans with Chief Still is the reentry pod in collaboration with the Adult Probation Department. And the Sheriff's Department is also getting Compass as a risk assessment tool, and we're going to begin using it, not just for this population, but for all our population is our final intent. We want to do risk assessment, validation, and part of this is also a validated jail classification system that we haven't had. We've had jail classification. It's very robust, but it hasn't been validated, and so by the National Institute of Corrections. So this will assist us. The other thing that we'll have at the reentry pod is, and we're actually going to have a conference call this afternoon with Chief Still and with members of my department, is trying to get some of the PRCSs to us ahead of time. She spoke a little bit about that, getting them to the county jail. I kind of feel like, you know, Chief Still's people have done a great job going to the prisons, getting those assessments, and then having the people show up. But they show up and hopefully get housing. Now we're going to have them in the jail locally, and we'll be able to address these issues and hopefully get them the housing, driver's licenses, the things that they're going to need in order to be successful on the outside. So those are some of the things that I think. So I'm excited about this. And the other part of this is the other people that come into us, the PRCSs, that may not be eligible for the reentry pod or will be here for a longer period of time, or the 1170Hs that are in our custody are also engaging in all our in-custody programs. And we have such a great deal of in-custody programs from that first woman's work furlough and men's work furlough that we used to have back in 1977. So we do have the Five Keys Charter School. It's a great program. It wasn't really in effect when I was back in the department. Now that I'm back, I'm very impressed with that. The Resolve to Stop the Violence programs, the Roads to Recovery. We have a cover program for veterans. So we have a dual diagnosis program for psychologically vulnerable people as well. So we have all these programs and our community programs, the Women's Resource Center, Survivor Restoration, SWAP, home detention. But what I think is exciting in terms of our community programs is also partnering with Wendy Still's department and others in order to make those more robust and to bring more people to those programs so that we're not always reinventing the wheel. So I think that's about all I need to tell you, unless you have some questions.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you
very much.
I wanted to invite Commander John Loftus, and thank you for spending so much time with us today, Commander, to speak about the impacts on the police department. And I know that there's no funding that's coming in through, so it may be increasing challenges on the police department.
Well, sir, it's very nice to be here. Good morning. Let me begin by saying the police department is very supportive of the efforts of the adult probation department and the partnership in their efforts to rehabilitate the prisoners. However, we are a public safety law enforcement organization, and when there are people released, and a lot of these folks have committed a number of crimes and been convicted of a number of felonies, when they are returned to the population, we would expect to see some kind of direct impact on crime levels. What we have seen to date from June of 2011 to June of 2012 is about a 16% jump in burglaries and about a 12 to 14% hike in the rate of auto boosts. Now, we can't attribute this directly to those who have been released under this program, obviously, but we do think there may be some kind of impact when we get 400 inmates from state prison systems out into the population. What we're doing to address these issues is we have a FRET unit, which is the Fugitive Recovery and Enforcement Team. That is a team of a sergeant and four officers whose sole function used to be to pick up parolees who have misbehaved and have warrants issued for them, or probationers. Because our staffing levels are a little lower, we have had to integrate that unit into our violence reduction team, but they still do carry out a lot of their daily duties with respect to picking up parolees and probationers and monitoring their activities. In addition to that, our gang task force does a lot of work with respect to hunting down fugitives who are gang members. Gang members obviously commit not just gang violence between other gangs, but they're also good for a good number of robberies and burglaries in the city. So that unit has gone out doing small operations about 100 times since this program has been implemented back in October of 2011. And they work very closely with adult probation. The biggest effort we have is the major FRET operation, which we work with the Sheriff's Department, the Adult Probation Department, the U.S. Marshal's Office, Parole Department. We run those operations quarterly. We use about 120 of our officers that work with the other agencies. And the way that is run is our FRET team will compile a list of about 200 targets for parolees at large, probationers who have violations on file, and they'll also do a number of compliance checks at residents. That program has been very successful. The last three times we've run it this year, there have been over 220 arrests, a good number of those felonies. So in our function is to try and arrest those people who are not going to take advantage of the services being offered by the other agencies, and try and with the public safety in mind, obviously try and keep San Francisco a safe city. Okay, any questions?
Supervisor Olagi.
Yeah, thank you for being here today. And I was going to ask, so if you kind of remove the issue of the return of so many, formerly incarcerated people to the area, you mentioned that there was an increase in burglaries and this sort of breaking into cars and sort of thing. Have you ever really looked at the nexus between the spike in that and like the unemployment rates and some of these other things that that we're currently in embroiled in? And then also, I was wondering if. I mean, at one time we had a community policing, I think, was something that, but I know that a lot of police have retired, and I believe that we will see on schedule the police academy classes, so we'll start to see more, folks fill in some of those gaps. But do you,
right.
I mean, I'm just wondering.
Well, to answer your first question, I believe, and I'd have to check the stats, but I believe crime actually went down during this most recent recession.
Okay.
Crime numbers are down, and most of our crime numbers are actually still down. We've noticed this mild uptick in burglaries that I wanted to bring to your attention, because we're specifically speaking
about
people whose last reason for incarceration was not a violent crime. It could have been a weapons possession, but a lot of these are theft suspects who have come out. And your other question relating to community service, we are still very active. We're very fortunate here in San Francisco.
Yeah.
Our police department, we have moved around some resources, like I mentioned, with our fugitive recovery our fugitive recovery enforcement team. We've been able to absorb them into the violence reduction unit. It's kind of like work, and we've been able to keep our community policing officers in place, and we still, you know, we are very, very committed to being a partner with our community here in San Francisco.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much,
my
Commander.
Pleasure.
The last speaker before we call Chief Still back up is Lonnie Kent from the Controller's Office. And thank you, everyone, for your patience through this hearing.
Interesting.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me. Lonnie Kent, I'm a project manager in the City Services Auditor Division of the Controller's Office. We provide analytical and technical assistance support to various city departments. So last fall, the CCPEC approached us and asked us to help them develop a data collection and reporting tool to support implementation of the realignment plan for the city and county of San Francisco. So we were super excited to come on board to do that. My office is always looking for projects that's trying to get at finding efficiencies across our criminal justice agencies. So we're really excited to be a part of this effort. What we are putting together will look somewhat like a data dashboard, not unlike what our public the public safety departments that spoke here today are already doing on a weekly basis, just putting out the numbers of the folks that are coming in, demographic information, the various types of information they've been presenting on these slides. We're trying to do that, but we're trying to do it from a system-wide perspective, so doing it cross-department as opposed to it being by department. So we're trying to define this population by, you know, the PRCS folks, the 1170H folks, the people that are on parole or that are in jail for parole violations, and trying to track them across the system and across departments and to see what types of what's happening with them, how long is it taking to get them connected to who they need to be connected with, and then what are the outcomes for these people. You know, we're also, you know, going to be able to do that by pulling them out by looking at their demographic information for each population and doing our best to get at information like the type of offense that the folks are being rearrested for. So we're basically trying to get as much data that we possibly can from the departments, throwing it into an Access database, and we're going to start running queries. It's been quite an effort getting to the point where we actually can create that Access database. Parallel to kind of developing this database, we've been working with our public safety agencies, with their business managers in each of their departments, to put the systems in place so that they can actually collect this information. So realignment, you know, is new to us, and our business practices have not had time or wasn't able to respond as quickly as our policymakers were able to respond to realignment. So we've been working with folks to get their data systems to a place where they can actually track the information that needs to be tracked, and then supporting them in trying to identify the trainings that need to happen in order to get their folks to track this information. So we, you know, that's been quite an undertaking. We affectionately refer to the Monday meetings that we have at the Hall of Justice with the business staff to be able to do that. The added value of this database that we're putting together, which is a little different from what the public safety departments are doing individually, is we are trying to, I think I said this already, but we're trying to measure the apples to apples across the system. So the information is going to, in my opinion, be a little bit more meaningful just in terms of looking at proportions and how folks are moving around. The other exciting thing about this is we have been communicating a lot with other jurisdictions about what they're doing in order to track this population. It's been an arduous process to get this data together. It's heartening to know that other people are having challenges too. But it seems like we're kind of, we are not, I don't know if we're completely ahead, if Chief still, you know, she brought us in pretty young or pretty early, but you know, other jurisdictions have been reaching out to us to figure out what we're doing, and we're sharing information and across counties. So we're trying to collaborate on that level too and learn from what other folks are doing. So as soon as we have some preliminary reports, we'll be sharing them with Chief Still and continue the collaboration.
Yeah, from the ACLU reports, and again, it's their public safety realignment report. they place data collection at the top, but it's a statewide problem, so it's great that kind of San Francisco is sharing with other counties. But is there anything that we're doing uniquely that's monitoring any differently policies and programs to see if they're working based on our data that other counties are not doing? I'm just curious, what are we doing different than other counties?
Well, from what I've seen from other counties, they have some very basic reports they're putting out that our folks have been doing for quite some time. What's going to be unique about this, what we're doing here, is that we've spent a lot of time defining the variables that we're measuring so that we're measuring the same variables across the system. So we're developing cross-departmental reporting capacity, which is very unique and very challenging to do because everybody talks about realignment differently depending on how it impacts their department, and then and it's fair, everybody talks about it differently and it's correctly, but correctly for them. So what we're doing here is we're trying to get it so we can talk about it correctly system-wide. The other jurisdictions that I've been communicating with are still kind of, their information is still siloed at the department level. So, you know, the way the sheriff defines an AB 109 person is quite different from the way DPH defines that person from the way APD defines that person. So when they develop these matrices that kind of measure trends over time, it's good information, but I think our information, we're putting in the effort to make sure our information is really focusing. It's a definitional issue. It's enough to make tear your hair out. Yeah, so we've been working a lot on just trying to get these definitions consistent across departments.
But thank you so much for the great work, Ms. Kent. Thank you.
Thank you for your work.
Sure.
And I'd like to just, to conclude, call up Chief Still to give concluding remarks before opening up for public comment.
I'll be brief. I just want to thank you very much for having the hearing today and giving us the opportunity to highlight some of the really great things that are going on in San Francisco, as well as some of the challenges, and point out that we've just released, it'll be on our website by the end of the day, a report of the San Francisco Adult Probation, basically the first 6 months of realignment and the impact on our department, and we've provided copies also. We hope to, our next report, which will be at the one-year mark, have collaborative information from all of the departments expanded into there. But we also ask for your approval of the official 2012 realignment plan as part of the process. And do you have any questions?
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
So now let's open this up for public comment. Is there anyone from the public? Mr. Paulson. 2 minutes, please.
Thank you. So take a good look at Public Safe. If your case does look out of place, if you look closer, it's easy to trace the tracks of your realignment tears. Don't fall into a burning ring of fire. You might go down, 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 and the bail will go higher. And it burns, 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 the city ring of fire, the ring of fire. Because you're mine, we walk the real line. Because I hope you do fine, and we'll walk the real line.
Thank you. Is there anyone else that would like to speak? Seeing none, public comment is closed. I guess I wanted to see if Supervisor Alagi wanted to make remarks before closing.
Well, I mean, I just think it's like we are at a really exciting time, and it's great to see how all these departments are working together and that the focus is really on rehabilitating the individual and giving people as many opportunities as we can provide, given our limited resources at times. So I just think it's exciting work, and also that the staff is being trained with the appropriate skills and insight to be able to deal, you know, most appropriately with the population in a way that benefits those individuals that are being released and being reintegrated into society. I think we still have a lot of things to work through, work out, you know, the cost of housing in San Francisco, employment opportunities and stigmas. that are still exist in society as a whole. So I think we still have a lot of obvious barriers that we all have to get through, that, you know, the individuals have to get through. But I'm excited that the collaboration is working so well at this point, and the communication between the department is so, and people are really trying and giving it an honest effort. So, you know, I just wish us all luck in reaching our, you know, our goals and stuff. So far, I think it's great work.
And I just wanted to thank Chief Still and all the department reps, really enlightening about the challenges we face and the impacts on our communities, but great, great models happening here in San Francisco. And I know that the funding kind of reform, the new formula helps, but I know we need so much more. But I'm really glad that I think this hearing has raised awareness about the programs and how much more we need to be supportive of them. And how unique San Francisco is, a place that's trying to keep our community safe, but with really innovative, out-of-the-box type programs, and now better cooperation and even just communication between departments, and also how we're impacting the rest of the state as well as we deal with the crisis of criminal justice and the budget crisis as well. So with that, I wanted to just move that we table item number one, the hearing, and that Supervisor Avalos, can we, or Supervisor Olagi, can we add you and Avalos as co-sponsors of number two?
Please, yeah.
And I move that we move it forward.
I mean, I can speak for myself. I obviously can't speak for Supervisor Avalos.
Oh, he did ask.
Okay, yeah. Great. Yeah, definitely.
I've moved that we, I think you're the vice chair as chair of the committee, so I make a motion that we move it forward with a positive recommendation.
A second, so.
Okay. So, without objection.
Yeah, without.
Thank you. So you're chairing the meeting.
Okay, so I guess we're moving towards adjournment now.
There are no further items.
What's that?
There are no further items.
Oh, there are no further items. So I'd like to move to adjourn the meeting. So.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone.